Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode. And I do want to remind people that this is 100% listener supported. And essentially, I've got no competition here in New Zealand. So if you want to start doing your own radio show, your own YouTube channel, and you don't want the corporate media to control you, you don't want to get a job in the mainstream media, you actually want to do something like, I don't know,
tell the truth through a camera and a microphone and some description.
Like you've got a conscience, you know, just start doing it. Okay, I remember one time, the very first time when I had this realization, went to a party, saw these guys, and they said, oh, well, we do green screening work and so on and so forth. And I was like, oh, yeah, can you get me into the film industry? And they're like, just do it, bro. And I just did. And voila, here we are, 32,000 YouTube subscribers later, the most YouTube subscribed news channel in New Zealand, with the largest collection of protests and public meetings in the country's history, mostly done all by myself, but with your support, financially, as well as emotionally, as well as sharing out all the links and so on and so forth. You play as vital a role as I do in the continued survival of this operation. Don't diminish your contributions. You're giving me $1.50 a week. That's $1.50 more than other people aren't giving me, right? Think about it. Every single time that you do something nice for somebody who's doing something good in the world, it speaks well of you and speaks well of us all. My very special guest joining me today is coming at us live from a caravan site in England where protesters against fracking are gathering. His name is Ian R. Crane. He used to work in the oil industry and he quit after that very high paid, very respectable job after he found out that some of the people in the oil wells of Iraq were indeed executed and the news said otherwise. Apparently it was Saddam's soldiers who came in and killed all the men who were guarding those oil derricks in Kuwait. No, unfortunately, it was the Americans who did it and blamed the Iraqis. If I got that wrong, Ian?
No, that's pretty much about it. Yeah, the official version of events, of course, you know, what are we now? Almost 26 years after that incident in Kuwait. And the official story is still that the retreating Iraqi forces set the wells alight in Kuwait. But the physical evidence, which I saw firsthand, would suggest that something different occurred. And as you rightly say, the U.S. Special Forces were tasked with setting the wells alight, the purpose being to demonize Saddam Hussein and effectively take Iraqi oil off the market. And in fact, I think it was in 2003, a member of the American Special Forces who was who claimed that he was part of the teams that set the wells alight actually went public. But funnily enough, you know, it hasn't appeared in the lamestream media. So 26 years after the event, you know, just like most people still believe that the U.S. had no foreknowledge of Pearl Harbor, that, you know, the Gulf of Tonkin incident didn't happen. And, you know, as you well know, Vinny, and I'm sure the vast majority of your viewers are aware that nothing in deep geopolitics happens by accident. And, of course, that continues today. I mean, it's only a couple of days. Well, it's what, 4 days, 5 days since we had another event in London on the...
The 22nd of the 3rd, what was it, 322, the number of skull and bones?
You know, and the irony is that, you know, the evening before I was speaking with a good friend of mine, and we were speculating on what might or might not happen on the following day, you know, because obviously it was also a year to the day since the bombing at Brussels airport. And I have to say that because... You know, I'm doing what I'm doing up here in the north east of England. It's not a caravan site, by the way. It's a field that we occupied to establish the anti-fracking camp. But I was actually on my way back to the southwest of England, and I stopped to meet with a friend. And it was 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and he said, "So, Ian, what's your take on what's happened in London this afternoon?" And I had no clue. I, you know, quickly got up to speed. And by the following evening, I mean, the good news is, Vinny, that now when any event like this occurs, there are literally thousands of people crawling all over the photographs, the video footage, the narrative. And, you know, once again, guess what? It doesn't stack up. There are so many holes in this. I mean, it's not quite as bad as 7/7. You know, the London bombings of 2005, and we're coming up to the 12th anniversary of that incident. And, you know, pretty much everybody in the alternative community absolutely knows that those four alleged perpetrators were not responsible for the London bombings. But of course, you know, the establishment and the lamestream work on the basis that, you know, just keep pumping out the narrative, keep repeating it. And the vast majority of, you know, the proletariat will, you know, not have the motivation to dig any deeper than what they read in the media.
What was really hilariously put out there, or at least from my cynical mind, it was freaking hilarious anyway. Hashtag, we are not afraid, after a huge fake terror attack gets repeated in the media thousands of times. Hashtag, we are not afraid. I'm like, does anybody else grasp the irony of this? They're literally telling you to be scared shitless at the same time that they release hashtags telling you not to be. I mean, now, the OSS, when it was originally formed up, wasn't actually involved so much in black operations and killing people and assassinations and so on and so forth. In fact, the operations of secret services for the United States' main job was propaganda. And a real great little thing, 101 facts about the CIA, but what was interesting to me, and this is something that only occurred to me after watching that video, is that one of the main causes or the reasons why you do propaganda, if you can't convince somebody of thinking your enemy's evil or convince your own people that you're good, is to at least confuse everybody.
Absolutely. But you know what? 20 years ago, we couldn't have said this, but the internet has created such an amazing opportunity. And, you know, your opening comments about encouraging people, you know, to set up their YouTube channel or their video blog is so important. You know, I mean, I always say to people, look, it doesn't matter. Even if you only have two or three people who, you know, watch what you put out or read what you put out, that's two or three people. And the great thing about the alternative media and people who get their information from the alternative media is they do not rely on a single source. They will look at multiple sources and then they will do their own research and then they will draw their own conclusion of what they believe to be the most likely probability. Always bearing in mind that, you know, basically, obviously, other more facts may come into play. And this is being borne out with the lamestream media. I mean, if you go on to, Wikipedia and you look at the statistics of the British media, and literally in the last 6 years, the print run of all of the national daily papers, newspapers, have fallen by 30%. I mean, this is enormous. In 6 years, the print runs have reduced by nearly one third. The BBC, which, of course, survives on the license fee, is in a real world of hurt because more and more people are just getting rid of their televisions because they basically know that, you know, the propaganda that's put out, you know, doesn't stand up to investigation. So, you know, people are seeking their news elsewhere. And even if they have a TV in their home, which they're using, you know, maybe to watch sport or whatever, or surf the web, but they're not watching the BBC. And so consequently, more and more people are saying, you know what, it's just lazy to rely on a single news outlet like the BBC or whatever to get my information. And, you know, people are sitting on their smartphones on the train and rather than reading the paper. And of course, they're looking at multiple sources. You know, obviously, if you buy half a dozen newspapers, that's a whole chunk of forest that you've got under your arm. And, you know, you really don't have the opportunity to, you know, scan through it and pick out what you want.
What I find the irony is, if you look through the paper and there's articles about deforestation in there.
exactly. I mean, it is, you know, a lot of it's recycled, but I mean, there's an absurdity about it. But, you know, I mean, the bottom line is that, you know, you can scan the online news, you see something which piques your interest, and then you can go do a search and you can find multiple sources of information or multiple perspectives on a particular incident or on a particular, you know, point of view, and not just take it from a single source. And what is, you know, not really surprising is you've got all the usual suspects trotting out in the British mainstream media. I mean, one was a classic. It's a historian by the name of Max Hastings. And, you know, he wrote an article in the Daily Mail, which is sort of, you know, right wing, independent, national. And he says, you know, it's at times like this, you know, we have to let the spooks have access to everything that we're doing. And it's like, hang on a goddamn second. You know, no, we don't. In fact, it's even more important to sort of try to protect your privacy, even though it's becoming increasingly difficult. But, you know, the reality is this is part of the technocratic agenda. You know, it's Technocracy Inc., the document that was written in 1932 by Howard Scott and Marion King Hubbard. And, you know, in 1932, they had the vision, but they didn't have the technology. Now they have the technology, and everything they wrote about in 1932 is coming into being. And you know what? When Eric Blair, George Orwell, wrote 1984, I don't believe he wrote it as a novel. I believe that he'd already written Animal Farm. And of course, he wrote Animal Farm as a warning against a left wing dictatorship, you know, disguised as communism. And I believe that he read Technocracy Inc. and then wrote 1984 as a warning against a right-wing dictatorship. And although, you know, there's elements of the current agenda which could arguably be labelled left, and there's elements which could arguably be labelled right. But the bottom line is where we are heading is a corporatocracy, a global corporatocracy. And obviously TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, and CETA, the Canadian equivalent, are all parts of this, which is to try and establish a raft of corporate legislation which sits above the sovereign legislation of each nation state. And so consequently, you know, regardless of the views of government, basically the corporations would effectively be able to overturn a government ruling because they would go to a corporate court and they would get the court to say, well, actually, the government can't make that decision because it impacts on this corporation's ability to make money. And, you know, everything is going in this direction. And anybody who has the audacity to challenge the corporatist agenda is effectively being labelled a domestic extremist or, you know, some equally outrageous title.
My favourite title was the non-violent extremist. You know, it was just like, I like that title because I'm extremely non-violent.
Exactly. You know, and I mean, you know, it's just like they had the think tanks in the US, like the Ayn Rand, you know, think tank in the 1950s and 60s, which came up with the term conspiracy theorist, you know, to undermine anybody who dared challenge the official version of events of
the Warren Commission.
Kennedy assassination. Yeah, exactly. And of course, you know, the conspiracy theorist is still used. But the reality is that, you know, an increasing number of people are realizing that if somebody throws the term conspiracy theorist around, what they're really saying is that they haven't had the opportunity or taken the opportunity to look at the situation. And so consequently, they are going to buy the establishment version of events, hook, line and sinker.
We mentioned Pearl Harbor before. Now, at the time, and this is very interesting nowadays because we talk about this these terrorist attacks, whether it be 9/11, 7/7, or the more recent 3/22 attacks in Brussels and the Charlie Hebdo attacks and so on and so forth. What is the government reaction every single time one of these attacks goes off without a hitch? we need to take rights away from the citizens, we need to give more power to the intelligence agencies who could have been able to prevent this. Now, guess what legislation was passed immediately after Pearl Harbor? You know, exactly the same kind of things. It says we need to give more budget to the OSS, and there was a failure of communication in between different agencies, and we need to have more conglomeration of the power of the state to surveil its own citizens and our overseas enemies so that we can protect you against this happening again. But what about the Australian intelligence who told you that there was a giant effing fleet of Japanese warships heading towards Pearl Harbor a week or two before they actually got there? Oh, well, we're just not going to tell people about that one. I mean, why would we? It means that our budgets would have to be reduced. It would mean that people would lose confidence in our oppressive state. And it means that millions of young, bright men who are the cream of the crop of society, the ones who have honour and discipline and a series of patriotic duty, sign up and die. Now, some of them returned alive, but they didn't return fully alive because of the things that they had seen and the things that they had done for their government in battlefields across the way. It didn't matter whether or not you came back alive. You didn't come back yourself. That's what we're talking about here, ladies and gentlemen, is a complete, total, full-spectrum dominance agenda against not only your country and your freedom, but against your very soul.
Well, let's have a look at some of the scripts, because the scripts keep getting repeated over and over. I mean, Pearl Harbor, it wasn't just the Australian intelligence that, you know, gave the US the information on the Japanese fleet movements. I mean, Churchill was advised that the fleet was moving, and Churchill deliberately didn't tell the Americans because he wanted the Americans to come into the war. But of course, the Americans actually wanting to come into the war, and that was the whole purpose of setting up Pearl Harbor. So let's have a look at some of the things that occurred. There was an admiral, and I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but there was an admiral who was responsible for the Pacific Fleet based in Pearl Harbor. And back in the early part of 1941, he became increasingly suspicious that Pearl Harbor was being set up as the bait to bring the Americans into the war. So he actually understood what was going on. He could see that his own government was starting to maneuver so that Pearl Harbor was the bait. And he started asking rather embarrassing questions. So he was removed and he was replaced by a much younger, very ambitious admiral by the name of Husband Kimmel. And Husband obviously was, I guess, sort of still intoxicated with, you know, getting this this promotion. So he didn't see the bigger picture and he didn't sort of ask the right questions. And when Pearl Harbor, after Pearl Harbor occurred, he was the fall guy. In fact, there were three separate inquiries into how Pearl Harbor could have possibly happened. And on each occasion, Husband Kimmel wasn't allowed to participate in the inquiry. And it was alleged that he, on the night of December 6th, he was partying and that, you know, there was drugs and alcohol. I mean, he was the classic demonized individual, you know. And in fact, it wasn't until, I think, 1996 when Bill Clinton came as close as he dare to granting Husband Kimmel a pardon when he said that Admiral Husband Kimmel was a full-blown American patriot. And that was not an exoneration, but it was an attempt to at least give the family some release from this trauma that they'd suffered for sort of 50-plus years where, you know, Husband Kimmel, Admiral Husband Kimmel had taken the full hit. Also, in addition, all of the, at the time, more modern ships were taken out of Pearl Harbor, and what was effectively bombed at Pearl Harbor was scrap. I mean, it was more or less set up like a film set to get the necessary reaction from the American public to enable the American government to enter fully into hostilities of World War II. And by the way, this is exactly, of course, why 9/11 occurred. And in fact, it was Zbigniew Brzezinski who wrote in The Grand Chessboard, which he published in 1997, And in the book, he says, and I can't remember the quote exactly, so I'll paraphrase, but he basically says that the American public, you know, are still reeling, despite the successes, inverted commas, of the first Gulf War. The American public are still reeling from the humiliation of Vietnam. And said, consequently, the American public do not have the stomach to enter into another sort of global conflict, except in the event of a catastrophic and catalytic external threat.
A widely perceived direct external threat.
And then, 3 years later, the PNAC think tank, the Project for a New American Century, pretty much plagiarized Brzezinski's comment from the Grand Chessboard in their document published in September of 2000, Rebuilding America's Defenses, where they basically said exactly the same thing, but they went a stage further and said that the American public would not agree to the American government getting involved in another global conflict, except in the event of a catastrophic and catalytic event like a new Pearl Harbor.
Now, incidentally, the reason why the Japanese decided to attack Pearl Harbor is because the US had already committed acts of war against them. What do you say
exactly.
That, Vinny? Well, do you know what an oil embargo does to a major economy? Do you know what a hemp embargo does to a major economy? That's why the Japanese actually invaded the Philippines out of their first major land invasions against the United States, because the Philippines was where the United States was growing the largest amount of its hemp that they had now refused to allow Japan to have access to on the open marketplace. That is an act of war. Oil embargoes as well. And so if you're, let's say, a tyrannical emperor and you've got your oil running out, your hemp that you make pretty much everything out of running out, and there's only one person to blame for it, you put off fighting that person for as long as you possibly can until you've got no choice, all right? The Japanese had no choice but to invade Pearl Harbor because America was already at war with them. Now,
that's exactly right.
Different perspective, isn't it? When you realize that, oh my God, all of these things that I've been told in school were absolute hogwash. Beautiful.
Yeah, but who writes the history?
The victors. And I love that kind of that real small mentality. We won! Yeah! It's just like, dude, you didn't win. Okay, whoever was in control of your forces and your country at that time won, but you and all of your fellow citizens lost, regardless of who wins the conflict.
The only winners were the bankers.
Yeah, pretty much. You
know, yeah, no, it really was. I mean, it's the bankers. I mean, we know that. I mean, the First World War. I mean, it was the Warburgs. Who were effectively the Warburg brothers, who were effectively financing both sides. Albert Pike, when he wrote Morals and Dogma, you know, back in the late 19th century, might as well have been writing the blueprint for the 20th century and actually into the 21st century. Because, you know, anybody who reads the 860 odd pages of Morals and Dogma, well, either looking back, you know, 150 years nearly, it is actually almost exactly 150 years. Well, you know, we'll either say that this guy either had remarkable foresight or it's effectively been taken as the script. And, you know, this is why, you know, deep geopolitical analysis isn't rocket science. All you got to do is dig out the documents and read the scripts. You know, I mean, obviously we have Albert Pike, who was obviously a very senior Freemason. Mm. But then, you know, we look at the works of Theodor Herzl, you know, the regarded as the father of Zionism, who effectively was developing on the theme, but from a Zionist perspective. And then, you know, we got Technocracy Inc. from the 1930s.
Interestingly, just inserting into that as well, David Livingstone, an author, has actually now found out that the vast majority of the practices of Freemasonry are actually from the Jewish Kabbalah. So the Jewish Kabbalah, yep. Zionism, and Freemasonry are like this. They're together.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, it's all inextricably interlinked. And the bottom line is that an increasing number of people are starting to realize that the globalist corporatist agenda does not have their best interests at heart. And an increasing number of people are stepping off the treadmill and, you know, finding ways to live their lives off the grid, as it were. But the challenge is not to opt out. I mean, I can completely understand why people do want to opt out, but, you know, and I'm choosing my words carefully, but the danger of opting out is that it is incredibly fucking selfish. Because what you're really saying is, you know what? I've had enough. I've had enough of the corporatist control. I've had enough of, you know, having my income bled dry through taxation, so that my disposable income is so minimalistic, you know, I can barely survive. I'm so fed up with, you know, 0 hours contracts. I don't know if you have them in New Zealand, but I mean, you know, supposedly we have full employment in the UK, but it's not employment as anybody would really know it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to step off the hamster wheel and I'm going to go and live in a caravan. And, you know, that's me. I'm all right, Jack. And that's what the establishment wants. The establishment wants people that become disenchanted to just walk away, go and live in, you know, a hobbit house or an earthship or a caravan and quietly get on with their lives. Because that way you are no threat to them whatsoever. What they are more concerned about is those people who not only step off the hamster wheel, but then find a way to either, you know, raise awareness amongst their fellow humans as to what's occurring and try and stimulate their own curiosity to take a look at what's going. And hopefully also find a way to thwart their increasingly outrageous agenda. Because, you know, I doubt very much that there's anybody watching us have this discussion, Vinny, who isn't aware that there is a global corporatist agenda to destroy our ecology, to effectively destroy our fresh water supply, to destroy our biosphere, you know, with the geoengineering, with the chemtrailing. I mean, the fracking is a totally unnecessary process for exploiting hydrocarbons. But what it is doing, on a deep level, it's destroying some of the ancient energy lines, ley lines, if you like, across the planet, whilst at the same time increasing the toxicity of our fresh water. And I mean, you know, not too far away from you, Southern Queensland has effectively been destroyed in the space of just 10 years. You know, the Great Artesian Basin has had the water sucked out of it at a rate six times greater than it can naturally replenish. And large tracts of Southeast Queensland in particular are now totally useless in terms of agriculture because
I saw the videos of the local Aussie activists going out there in a canoe and holding a lighter over the river. And just woof, this huge freaking plume of flame just comes right out. And it's a river on fire. That is disgusting.
Yeah. I mean, you know, basically, I mean, obviously you have got the situation where some people can set light to the water. The Condamine River. The Condamine River has got so much methane coming into it. In fact, Jeremy Buckingham really pissed off a lot of people because he took great delight in trekking to the Condamine River and setting it alight, and then left everybody else to deal with the problem of putting it out. But you know, the Condamine River eventually flows into the Murray Darling. You know, so ultimately, the toxicity of the Condamine is potentially going to impact, you know, in the city water supplies.
Well, it's not just the city water supplies, because the Murray River supplies almost all of the farms within that entire region and all their fruit groves with all their fresh water as well. So not only water's the essence of life, food's the second essence of life, and this one kills both of them like that.
And what people conveniently ignore is that we are now paying more for water than we are for gasoline.
I certainly am.
Yeah.
I've got to go out there and cost me, what was it, 20 bucks to get 20 to get 20 liters of water just in a thing. What was it, maybe actually $12.95 now if I get the refills, if I've already got the plastic thing and whatever, because I can't drink our tap water. It actually makes me start feeling sick and like smell it, and smells like chlorine and all of that kind of stuff. And it's like, bro, chlorine's a freaking carcinogen. It was used to make mustard gas in the First World War, and you're asking me to freaking drink it? Right? And I was talking to this talk radio show host on, I think it was Radio Live a couple of years back or whatever, and I made this point about chlorine, and she totally misinterpreted it and goes, but think about all the places that don't have fluoride in the water. And first of all, I wasn't talking about fluoride, I was talking about chlorine. And then I went, what, like 97% of Europe? You know, they're just all toothless swine in Germany, aren't they? You know, they just don't know how to do it right.
Yeah, and I mean, the irony is, you know, here we are in North Yorkshire trying to protect the UK from the unconventional gas industry, i.e. fracking, and yet I can't drink the local water here because of the high chlorine content. And I can't even boil it and use it for tea and coffee because the chlorine content is so high. So, you know, we're in the ironic situation of literally having to go and buy bottled water, you know, for the basics, for tea and coffee. And you know, people say, but you know, no, but I'm paying £1.20 for a litre of fuel, but I'm only paying a pound for a litre of water. And I say, yeah, but once you remove the taxation from the fuel, then you are paying more for your water than you are for your oil, petrol or diesel at the pump. And you know, this, 40 years ago, in my youth, it was unthinkable that you bought bottled water. I mean, buying bottled water was something the French did, you know, and it actually never fails to amuse me that Evian backwards is naive. I think somebody saw us coming, you know.
Well, and what's interesting is that I think it was. I might actually have the documentary here. So here we are. That's what I was after. This beautiful one here. It's called the Great Culling by Paul Wittenberger. They're the guys of the makers of Why in the World Are They Spraying? And they had this beautiful section in it where they talk about fluoride being so frickin' dangerous that it'll actually eat through the stockings and the leggings of the women who are actually going into work at these big phosphate fertilizer factories and stuff like that. Like, while they walk from their car to the office, their leggings would be ripped apart by the fluoride molecules in the air. And they go, well, you know, it'd be really good. Let's dump that in the drinking water.
Yeah. I mean, there's an absurdity, you know. I mean, I turned 60 last year, and I have to say that, you know, whilst I'm sure the world wasn't as much different as I might like to think it was just that I didn't know as much as perhaps I do now. But my great concern, you know, my youngest son is 14, and my great concern is the legacy that we are leaving future generations, because you know, primarily, these socio-psychopathic global corporatists are able to get away with the shit that they do because we let them. You know, we, when I say we, I'm talking about the collective we, you know, and a big part of this, particularly, you know, in the arguably developed world, is this fake austerity, which is intended to keep as many people as possible literally on the brink of starvation, so that, you know, they are literally using every damn hour God sends to try to, one way or another, raise enough money to keep a roof over their head and food on their table.
Interesting,
and therefore
side
they're
note.
Not a threat to the establishment.
Interesting side note. Keeping the nutrition content and amount of food very low is a cult indoctrination technique.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, you take a look at it. We've already talked about the water, the chlorine content, the fluoride. You know, fortunately in the UK, the vast majority of the UK doesn't have fluoride, but there are pockets that do. And the intention, of course, is to push fluoride right across the country. But, you know, it's everything. It's the vaccination program. You know, the 26 vaccinations in the UK that a child is expected to have had before they start school, 36 in the US. As you rightly say, you know, the diminishing nutritional value of food. In fact, what is sold in the supermarkets, I mean, actually, they should be pulled up under the advertising standards legislation because it's not food. I mean, you know, in fact, you'd get more nutrition probably from eating the packaging than you do, you know, the stuff that's inside it. You know, and so consequently, organic produce is unfortunately not cheap. So that becomes the, you know, the domain of the wealthy. So, you know, the air we breathe, the water we drink, the food we eat, the vaccinations, and then God forbid if you happen to get sick and then you become part of the revenue stream for Big Pharma. And, you know, my father, who's in his late 80s, and, you know, I mean, he's lived, you know, a good and full life. But in his late 80s, obviously, his health is starting to diminish. And, you know, he was showing me recently the pills that he takes. And then he was saying, you know, I take these because the side effects for these. And then I have to take some others because of the side effects for the others. And you know, basically, every time he takes a new medication, he can pretty much guarantee that a few weeks later, he's going to have to take something else to deal with the unwanted effects of the medication that he was prescribed previously. So, you know, it's actually quite remarkable that he doesn't rattle when he walks. But, you know, I mean, he is a godsend to the pharmaceutical industry because, of course, he's, you know, contributing very significantly to their revenue stream. And the problem that, you know, we've got is an increasing number of kids, particularly again in the developed world, being diagnosed ADHD, you know, a major contributor of which is the crap food and the particularly the aspartame or aspartame, depending on where you're sitting on the Atlantic. And consequently, you know, they're becoming hyper. They go to the doctor. And what do they describe? Ritalin or Zoloft. You know, and these are psychoactives. And consequently, when kids are prescribed these medicines, it invariably leads to greater problems. And in fact, there is a website called SSRI Stories, and I believe it's .net. But if you just punch in SSRI Stories, that's SSRI stands for Selective Serotonin Reuptake Inhibitors. Which is effectively antidepressants. I mean, not exclusively, but primarily antidepressants, but or similar drugs that have a psychoactive effect. And in this, on this website, what you'll see is a database by country of all of the like high school shootings or violent crimes that have occurred amongst people taking this medication. And the percentage of people who take this medication who commit violent crimes or show signs of aggressive behavior or ultimately commit suicide is phenomenal. But, hey, you know, it's all part of the revenue stream and it's all part of the Great Culling.
And what's great about it as well is because of those murders and because of those suicides in record numbers, a whole bunch of people get either scared or depressed because of it and go to a doctor to get more of it so that they become the next murder-suicide story.
Brilliant! Oh my God! It's like advertising smoking, because as soon as they start smoking, they get addicted to it!
You know, it's just freaking out of control, bro. If you would like the evil overlord of all scumbaggery to be created in the universe, even you couldn't come up with shit this evil.
Yeah, you couldn't. I mean, it is in the scheme of things, from their perspective, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. And it's so brilliant that, you know, even though all the information is out there and people can do their own research, you know, they will still succumb. And I mean, I'll give you a minor example. I mean, you know, I'm very fortunate. I've, had a pretty good health throughout my life. But, you know, I'm at an age where certain conditions kick in. And so I needed to go see a specialist recently. And he said, you know, what we need to do is a prostate biopsy. And I politely said that wasn't going to happen.
So you didn't prostrate yourself before him, did you?
Prostate. So I said, I'm sorry, but that's not going to happen. And he said, well, what's the alternatives? And I said, you know very well what the alternative is. The alternative is that I have an MRI scan. And so he said, well, you know, the current standard procedure in the UK is that we do the biopsy. And after the biopsy, we decide whether the scan is necessary. And I said, well, you know, that may be the way it works. But I said, I will forego the biopsy and I will wait for the opportunity to have the scan. Well, I was very fortunate. The scan came up in a couple of weeks. Right now, I'm just waiting on the results. But then what do I read? One of those synchronistic moments. I come out from having the MRI scan and I pick up a national newspaper, one of the falling circulation ones. And the first article that I read is that there's a urology conference going on in London last weekend. And the first article I read is that how many men in their 50s and 60s are being subjected to unnecessary biopsies when it's well known that a biopsy can cause more problems than it actually resolves. And the right way to do it would be to give people an MRI scan first.
And the,
so why do you think it is they give the biopsy before the MRI scan?
Well, the technical term for that is a biopsy.
Yeah, well, there you go, yeah.
Like, you get this medical jargon down you, and I love to say to people, do you know what arthritis means in Latin? No, it means joint pain. So you get these people who have learned a dead language so that they can speak to you in it and confuse you about what's going on when they really don't even know what's going on.
Oh, exactly. So anyway, I mean, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the National Health System is there to help us with diagnosis. And then having helped us with the diagnosis, the onus is on each of us individually to decide how it is that we're going to address whatever problem it is that's diagnosed. You know, we have to get away from this situation where the doctor knows best. No, they freaking don't. The doctors in most cases are little more than front of house salesmen for the pharmaceutical companies or for, you know, particular procedures. So, you know, it is, the onus is on each and every individual to step into their own sovereignty and start making their own decisions rather than, you know, allowing the establishment to make decisions for them. That's how everybody has been conditioned. And I'm pleased to say that an increasing number of people are stepping outside of the conditioning. But hey, you know, the next stage is actually getting people to engage in the process of bringing about the changes that we all know we need to see. Because if we don't, you know, the legacy that we are going to pass on to future generations actually doesn't bear thinking about.
Now, you talked about that concept of this we, this collective we need to do something about it. And I started off like that, and about maybe, I think it was maybe 5-6 years into it, I realized that the I is actually the most important, because if I think about how many projects I tried to start up where I got other people involved and how many of them actually went nowhere, and how many things I started by myself that I got going, got running, and actually either finished or got to a certain point and then merely asked for help to continue. There's simply no comparison. And I think what's part of the most important agenda is to rob people of their own individual abilities. Now, this comes down to this word reputation. Okay, if I go to a doctor and I don't know this doctor, never heard of him before, haven't interviewed him before, and so on and so forth, I have no background on his information or his reputation whatsoever. And the other day I was having a few drinks with a friend of mine, Clint Meyer, who does New Zealand Fire Dragon chili sauces, and he has won X amount of awards for doing the best chili sauce in the world, X amount of awards for the hottest chili sauce in the world. So I know he has a reputation for being the best chili sauce maker in the world. And it's fun to actually talk to people who are really, really good at what they do and have a track record of being really, really good at what they do. And this is the reason why I like doing my show, because I get to expose all the listeners to people that I admire because they are who they are, they do what they do, and they didn't need help to begin it. They only need people's help to continue doing what they're doing.
No, there's a hell of a lot in that, and it's important that, you know, we do give other people the platform. And as you know, I mean, that's what I do with my shows, Fracking Nightmare and Humanity vs. Insanity. It's really important to give people the platforms that they need to, you know, get their message out there. But I think, you know, the reason I use the collective we is because individually, of course, we can make a contribution. We must make that contribution. But individually, we ain't going to change jack. It's only when, you know, we get together and we start working collectively. And I mean, the reason that the anti-fracking campaign is currently being so successful in the UK, I mean, we haven't had a frack in the UK since the moratorium was lifted in December 2012, and we only had one which went wrong, which led to the moratorium before that. But the reason that we have been so successful and that we are such a thorn in the side of the government and the industry is because, you know, we go around to the communities and we basically have to say to the community, look, ultimately, you know, we can't stop this. We individually, who might know a thing or two about the unconventional gas industry, but we can't stop this. But we can help you. We can help give you the information that you need to share amongst your community, encourage the people in your community to do their own research. And once they've done their own research, then obviously they can decide whether this is something they want in their or anybody else's backyard. And of course, because of, you know, the nature of the industry and its track record, wherever it's tried to establish a footprint in the world, is pretty disastrous. So in theory, it should be a no-brainer. And, you know, we still have a few people who think it's a good idea, but, you know, there's always...
Well, like you said, it's a no-brainer. So if you don't have any...
exactly. Yeah, that's about right. If you don't have any grey matter... Actually, if you don't have a heart, you know, if you don't have the heart of a human... And you know, you don't have that connect with your environment, with your ecology. And that's why the oil and gas industry puts people who are not from that country, you know, in charge of these projects. So, you know, we got one guy is an Australian driving it. We got, you know, an Irishman coming over to the UK. We got a Scot who comes down to England. And then we got the nuclear waste disposal project in the UK, which is being driven by a Texan. And it's really important to actually put people, for the companies, it's really important to put people into the lead role in these projects who have no emotional connection with the country, with the environment. But, you know, of course, the people who live here, they do. And so, you know, obviously, once we could get a community engaged, then, you know, it can make the life for the unconventional gas industry extremely difficult. And that's our goal. Make it so difficult that it becomes so expensive that it's not viable. So effectively, they pull out. Mm. So, I mean, that's just one example. I mean, we have other issues, obviously, with the bailiffs. You know, we have a group in the UK called Beat the Bailiffs. And they've effectively modelled themselves on the way the anti-fracking community has modelled itself. You know, unlike in Australia, where there is a hierarchical anti-fracking organisation called Lock the Gate. And if you go into Queensland, you won't find too many people who have anything complimentary to say about Lock the Gate. But, you know, we can learn from the experiences in Australia. And so, you know, what we have tried to do in the UK is make sure that there is no hierarchy. You know, it's a completely horizontal organization. It's like a hydra on a hydra. You know, you cut one head off and 100 appear in its place.
That's actually that's actually a fractal.
Yeah, there you go. It's a fractal. Exactly. Unfortunate use of the first syllable there. But, yeah, it is effectively a fractal. And a fractal to address fracking. I like that. I might requote you.
Fractal fracking. All right. Fractal versus fracking.
Let's develop the point, because it's a crucial element. This is how you challenge the establishment, because the establishment knows how to deal with a hierarchy, because that's the way it operates. It knows how to deal with it. So what you have to do is you have to come up with something that it has no experience of. It doesn't know how to deal with it. And basically, you do exactly what the establishment tries to do with its false flags. You try and just create as much confusion as possible so they have no idea where you're going to come at them next.
That's right, because hierarchical structures, indeed, this is another, what was it? I think it was the Gnostic teachings who talked about the infection of archontic entities. And these entities attach onto the lower brain stem and are obsessed with hierarchy. And I think it was Mark Twain who once said that if you ever want to destroy an organization, or what was it? If you ever want to destroy a good idea, turn it into an organization.
Absolutely. And, you know, and I mean, you still see it. I mean, you get some communities who say, yeah, well, we've got to have a chairman, we've got to have a secretary, we've got to have a treasurer. And of course, what you're doing, if you do that, you're playing right into their hands, because the establishment knows how to deal with that. You know, because all you do is you find the influential people in that hierarchical structure, like the chairman or like the treasurer, and you manipulate them. Whereas if you've got a completely horizontal structure where you might have strong characters, but there is no defined leadership. You know, and, you know, one of the mantras that we try and push within the anti-fracking community is, if you think of a job, you got it. You know, go do it. And you change the linguistics as well. So whereas in a normal environment, you find people saying, you know, what we need to do is this, or what you should do is that. And we've changed that so that, you know, basically, if somebody makes that kind of observation or comment, we say, whoa, actually, we're not interested in hearing about what we should do or, you know, what you should do. What we want to hear is what you are doing. So we, you know, what we encourage is people to say, you know what, I'm doing this, or I'm going to contribute to that. I'm going to support this. I'm going to, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But change the whole dynamic into one that's active as opposed to passive.
And get active, ladies and gentlemen. Make a difference and go out there and frickin' do it. Heaps of people do. All right, thank you. Ian R. Crane, we'll see you again sometime, folks.